He is one of America's prominent sports commentators and columnists,
known for his fearless opinions and passionate dialogue.
I know, it's sad, but the best sports conversation has absolutely nothing to do with sports.
He has perfected the Daily Sports Podcast, having produced hundreds of topical, credible shows without even a hint of fake news.
No filters, no mute buttons, no BS, just me and whatever the hell I feel like talking about.
He has done 1,700 TV shows, written 8,000 columns, broadcast hundreds of talk shows, published a book.
He has covered every major sports event nationally and worldwide.
And yet, we still can't shut him up.
The ceiling is the roof.
And now from Los Angeles, inside his studio by the Pacific Ocean,
where he plans on hanging out with a beer immediately after this podcast is recorded.
Oh, man.
Here he is, Jay Mariotti.
The show is unmuted. I'm Jay in Los Angeles. And as Donald Trump harumphed on 60 Minutes, that's what he does, harumph, and the Red Sox were beating the Astros in the baseball playoffs, guess who stole the night? Sunday Night Football stole the night in Foxborough, which won't make Trump or Major League Baseball very happy, but it did have tens of millions of viewers affixed to their screens to the very end. To the chagrin of football doomsayers everywhere, the NFL has rebounded in ratings and watchability this season with an injection of fun and new names and a minimizing of national anthem protests. And the Patriots and the Chiefs delivered the season's most entertaining game. All the hype going in lived up to it, and then some, with the greatest quarterback ever, Tom Brady, outdueling a dazzler who might someday, who knows, lay claim to that prize, Patrick Mahomes. Brady's defiance of age and time should never be taken for granted. And late in the fourth quarter, you saw him break free of the rookie linebacker, Breland Speaks, and storm into the end zone for the go-ahead touchdown. When I saw that, two things crossed my mind. One, Tom Brady is 41 years old. And two, the fact that Speaks released Brady from the grasp is a byproduct of these new safety rules protecting quarterbacks. And sure enough, a new round of hell is breaking loose about how lenient and soft those rules are. From my vantage point, Speaks should not have released Brady because it was clear he wasn't nailing Brady with a full-on 100% body hit a la Clay Matthews. Safety first here. But in this case, you have to teach your tacklers, and he's a rookie, if you're not doing anything blatantly wrong, go ahead and complete the sack. To Brady's credit, he fought through it. The rookie releases him, and Brady heads for the end zone. Classic Tom Brady. Regardless of that snafu, Mahomes came right back with a huge play, a 75-yard touchdown to Tyreek Hill, fastest player in the NFL, leaving it to Brady to hit a strike to who else? Rob Gronkowski, and win on a field goal as time expired. Offense is king in the NFL more than ever, and these two teams have the quarterbacks and the playmakers to meet again in January. In the end, I think it'll come down to whose defense is less vulnerable. On this night, the Patriots survived by the very crooked number of 43-40 on a very joyous night in New England for more than one reason. Here was Tom Brady, who sprinted across the field to greet Mahomes after his 200th career NFL victory.
I want to ask you about your four-yard touchdown run. Did you feel that you were getting tackled at the time? You fake throwing the ball, and the guy let go of you. Were you surprised you even got to the end zone?
Yeah. I didn't know what happened. They had, you know, they doubled three guys on the play, and I'm just glad. You know, I got to watch it tomorrow, but I got close to the goal line and figured I'd just try to get it in. We needed it.
And here was Patrick Mahomes, the future of quarterbacking, and maybe one of the new stars who actually can save football from itself.
I never don't believe in ourselves and this team. I think that we can win within every situation. Coach Reed puts us through training camp in the worst situations possible, and I feel like we have to find ways to win those games. Tonight we didn't, but I feel like just that fight and that competitiveness and everything that we did is it shows the true team and who we are.
And with apologies to Justin the Babe Turner, bullpenning, platooning, and that Bob Uecker statue in the back row in Milwaukee, I believe the World Series is being played right now, at this moment, and none of the aforementioned elements is involved. No, October is all about the Astros and the Red Sox, who have combined for 218 victories this season as baseball's two foremost behemoths, and they're colliding in the American League Championship Series. And a potential seven-game marathon for the ages, and that's no hyperbole, returns to Houston tied at one, with the Red Sox actually winning a game started by David Price. Not that Price was effective in Game 2, but the offense was more than enough, ignited, as usual, by Mookie Betts and a decisive three-run triple by Jackie Bradley Jr., who made Jackie Bradley Sr. proud. The big issue at the moment is Sox ace Chris Sale, who was hospitalized, and this is some mysterious stuff here, for a stomach illness. He was kept overnight for evaluation. Who knows if this is going to be the undoing of the Red Sox, who are trying to piece together a starting rotation loaded with big money arms and Cy Young Award winners, yet you can't rely on anybody on any given night. And does closer Craig Kimbrel have to make everything an adventure, as he did again at the end of Game 2? But for now, on a night when a spoiled New England regaled in the Red Sox and the Patriots sharing primetime TV windows, we have seen a crack in the armor at last in the Astros, who still might prove to be the most complete team and best culture we have seen in years in Major League Baseball. I'm not ruling the Astros out. I'm still picking them. George Springer and Alex Bregman are monsters, but the Astros need more from their potent offense, as Carlos Correa continues to deal with a back problem, and the Red Sox did get the starter Garrett Cole in Game 2. The Sox looked real sloppy in Game 1. Manager Alex Cora looked like a rookie with that foolish ejection, 10 walks among various mental and physical mistakes, but the Red Sox rebounded. All along, I've predicted a repeat World Series title for the Astros, a more complete team with better equilibrium, higher energy, a recent championship savvy, and I'm not going to hedge now, even after their first loss of the postseason. Here was Alex Cora.
I mean, I know they send a memo radio, they talk about it. Actually, I was walking into the batting cage, and on the TV, I saw the tweet by the organization, you know, and he was feeling bad, you know, and he's at the hospital. For what I know, it's nothing serious, you know, but obviously, you know, whenever you have to go to the hospital, you gotta, you know, be quote-unquote worried, but he should be fine. Hopefully, we get news in the upcoming hours, and, you know, he'll join us in Houston.
And here in the other clubhouse was A.J. Hinch, the manager.
I thought he settled in nicely. You know, he got into a little bit of a weird inning, ground ball base hit, a little unlucky on the near great play by Marwin, a little bit of a pitch around on Devers, gets the punch, and then Jackie Bradley, you know, hits one up off the wall. So the line's going to indicate a little bit tougher on him than he pitched. I thought he found it at the end.
In contrast, the National League Championship Series is a matchup of two stubborn, unconventional theories born of the analytics era. The Brewers believe they can win a pennant by minimizing starting pitching and employing the same three or four relievers every game, or so it seems, not understanding that those relievers are easily burned out the longer the series goes, right? And the Dodgers, of the $197 million payroll, believe they can platoon with depth and move their versatile players around the field as if front office executives Andrew Friedman and Farhan Zaidi are playing a video game, often to the point of overkill, reducing talented players to interchangeable robots. The other day, Dave Roberts, the manager, just about drained the entire bullpen and bench, and I'm wondering, if that thing goes 13 innings, what is going on in this game? The first two games of the NLCS went 7.5 hours, included 23 pitching changes. In Game 3, I should note, played on Vin Scully Avenue exactly 30 years to the night that Kirk Gibson hit his legendary home run. I don't know what that means, but I do think this series goes 7 games because of this two-sided attrition factor going on. Milwaukee manager Craig Counsell should have stuck in Game 2 with Wade Miley, his opening pitcher. He was doing brilliantly through 5 2/3 innings, but Counsell stayed true to the algorithm that no pitcher who opens the game should ever see the opposing lineup a third time. I don't know why not, if Miley is doing great work. That dictum backfired on the Brewers, who have gone to Jeremy Jeffress way too much this postseason, to the point a strength has become a weakness. It was Jeffress who allowed that go-ahead home run in the eighth inning to Justin Turner, who truly, along with George Springer, is a new Mr. October. Just look at his history. As the Dodgers scored 8 runs against Milwaukee relievers in the first 2 games, all in the 7th inning or later. And what about Josh Hader? He couldn't pitch in Game 2 because he went 3 innings in Game 1. That's Counsell twisting himself into a pretzel, a logical pretzel. Steely Dan, once upon a time, pretzel logic. So it serves Milwaukee right that Turner would inject common sense into the equation, hitting his 7th career postseason homer, his 4th playoff go-ahead homer since 2013, and continuing this October pace exceeded in baseball history only by Babe Ruth. And if you think I'm kidding, Turner's home run Saturday gave him a .319 average, .439 on base percentage, and .556 slugging percentage in the career postseason. Only Ruth has higher figures in all 3 categories among hitters with a minimum of 150 postseason plate appearances. This is no red-headed stepchild, JT. He is the unlikely king of Chavez Ravine, a New York Mets castoff who dramatically changed his swing a few years ago. Think launch rate, another geek era device, launch rate. And Turner became the very definition of clutch. In Echo Park, right near the ballpark, there's a restaurant with a gigantic mural of Justin Turner with all the flowing red hair. And to think Turner struck out 4 times in Game 1 for the first time in his career, Roberts, whose job may depend on the outcome of the series, was not surprised by the bounce back.
It did upset him. And it takes a special athlete to have a night like he had last night and to show up the next day in a big spot and want to have the bat in your hand. Justin is that guy, and those are hard to come by.
Turner's heroics will be needed. The Dodgers again dealing with a regressing, inconsistent Clayton Kershaw, whose velocity continues to drop as hitters zone in on both his hittable fastball and slider, once his most reliable off-speed pitch, that slider. Milwaukee, the city, still buzzing over pitcher Brandon Woodruff's home run off of Kershaw, whose all-time prominence in the regular season continues to be dulled by his postseason struggles. So much for the good vibes. Chris called this, by the way, after his previous start, and now the Dodgers, depending on Walker Buehler and Rich Hill to bail them out, as their bullpen is just not as strong and multivariate as in past postseasons. And for somebody who seeks the sport's all-time biggest contract this coming offseason, Manny Machado continues to dog it. I don't know if he's hurt or what. I don't think he's hurt. But the last series, he said at one point after a loss to Atlanta, baseball was only a game. And then in Game 2 of the Milwaukee series, he did not hustle down the line on a groundout. Joe Buck noticed it on Fox. So did Hall of Fame pitcher and broadcaster Jim Palmer, who took to Twitter and called Machado's jog pathetic. Does Manny Machado not care? It's October, trying to win a World Series here, first time in 30 years. Maybe that's why the Dodgers have shown little interest so far in signing him long-term. Just a rental at this point. For decades, Bob Costas repeatedly rejected our pleas that he pursue the baseball commissionership. Now I'm going to nominate John Smoltz for the gig. Not at all afraid to hit the MLB hierarchy right where it hurts. The games are too long. They don't have enough action. They are dominated by analytics spreadsheet geekery. The Fox analysts continue to lobby for a ban on all shifting so that more offense returns to the game, more fun returns to this wheezing sport. Here was Smoltz on one of his many sermons on the topic on Fox.
We've had this discussion, at least I have, because I keep talking about the state of the game and where baseball is, and sometimes, well, more times, there's lack of action, more strikeouts, less balls put in play. And the subject has come up on how do you increase action and get more balls in play in baseball.
And your answer is?
You can eliminate the shift. And what it would do is start rewarding guys instead of always lifting the ball away from the shift, because we've already seen hitters won't take the shift out by themselves hitting the ball the other way. You can eliminate, just like other sports have done. NBA's had illegal defenses. You've had different things go on in different sports and rule changes. That's one way of doing it, because now what isn't rewarded and isn't taught to hit the ball on the ground would be rewarded again, because certain guys have a pattern of when they hit the ball on the ground on the right side, they're out. Not so much if you eliminate so many defenders on one side of the field.
Meaning you need two on the right side of the second base bag, two on the left side.
Yep. There's going to be things that come down the road that people are just going to have to embrace. If the game continues the way it is, with the amount of strikeouts, we're on pace for over 10,000 more baseballs not put in play this year than last year.
Hallelujah, John Smoltz. Also this postseason, we are seeing too many hitters stepping out of the box, pitchers stepping off the rubber. They're trying to establish their rhythm and their ground, oblivious to pace of play. Too bad nobody's listening, John. Commissioner's not listening either. Right now, it's cha-ching time, October, the best ad rates. The owner's too busy enjoying their profit margins, and they're gearing up for the possible lockout after the 2021 season, even as TV ratings continue to suffer. This is so maddening. I've done three topics on baseball to lead this podcast today, and all along I'm thinking people care a hell of a lot more about football and the NBA and other things in sports. So the 6-0 Los Angeles Rams are the NFL's only unbeaten team, with Todd Gurley rambling for a career-high 208 yards and Robert Woods and Brandon Cooks making enough big plays in the passing game for Jared Goff, though the Broncos did make it close at the end. Did you notice the hoodies, the snow, the puffs of breath coming out of the helmets of the Rams players on that below-freezing day? I think the Colorado cold and altitude may have bothered them a bit, those L.A. boys. Not that it will matter if the Rams have home field advantage in the NFC playoffs. They have not dominated of late. They will be tested November the 4th in New Orleans and later in the month in Mexico City against Mahomes and the Chiefs. Here was Todd Gurley.
Oh, it means a lot. You know, it doesn't matter how you get the win. At the end of the day, it still says 6-0, and that tells you a lot about this team. You know, might not be the prettiest wins the last couple, but we found a way, and that's what great teams do.
It's almost criminal that John Gruden, at $100 million over 10 years, is paid more than Bill Belichick and every other coach in American professional sports history. Gruden has single-handedly wrecked a Raiders franchise that only recently had been headed in the right direction under Reggie McKenzie and Jack Del Rio. What the hell happened to Jack Del Rio? The Khalil Mack trade was a farce, of course, but now Gruden's very credibility as a football coach is under attack after the Raiders were mauled by the Seahawks in London, with Gruden now rumored to be launching a fire sale in which he's trying to get rid of Amari Cooper, Carl Joseph, pretty much anybody on the roster other than Derek Carr, who is banged up at the moment. The Raiders waited until Thursday night to take that 11.5-hour flight to England, and they played like they were still asleep in a 27-3 loss to Seattle, in which Carr was sacked six times, injuring his left arm on the last one. I'm not laughing at the sack. I called this thing. I'm the one who said it would be 30-0 Seattle. It was 27-3. Imagine if you had traveled from America, a Raiders fan, to be one of the 85,000 people in attendance at Wembley Stadium. You would be demanding a full-blown refund, as Carr empathized.
it beats me up. It hurts my heart to lose. It hurts my heart for our fans, for the ones that traveled all this way, right? Think of it in human sense, right? A lot of people traveled all that way, and we just got beat like that. You know, that hurts me. You know, that is painful, but it doesn't change the way I work. It doesn't change the way I play. I listen to my coaches. He tells me, you did this good, you did this good, now do this better, do that better. That's what I do. No matter what, you know, whether we win or lose, win 12 games, or we're sitting here one and whatever, I don't change. And I know that our leaders don't either.
If the Steelers turn around their turbulent season, they will remember an October afternoon in Cincinnati where the toxic Antonio Brown, who throws sideline tantrums and furniture out of 14-floor condo buildings, found an open seam on a full-out Bengals blitz and caught the winning score from Ben Roethlisberger. This after Brown was lucky to get up after a Vontaze Burfict cheap shot. This has become the NFL's ugliest rivalry. Remember all of that vicious stuff a year ago? And Ryan Shazier was paralyzed in that game. More on Ryan in a minute. You have Juju Smith-Schuster after this game accusing Burfict and the Bengals of making threats to him. And Antonio Brown sounded as beat up as he looked after this victory. Antonio Brown sound here. Pick it up.
Just, you know, a nasty hit. I think I was able to come back in the game, finish the game. Anytime you come in here, you know, they call it the jungle. You know, it's going to be some hard hitting, some plays that could be challengeable as far as the calls. But I was grateful to get back up and come back in.
Feel like I was beyond the limit of the
rules? I don't know. You know, I couldn't really see how he hit me, but I felt it, but I was able to, you know, get back up and finish the game.
For a much-needed perspective here, Shazier, who suffered a spinal injury at Paul Brown Stadium last year, received cheers from the fans as he walked onto the field in the pregame. It's obvious the Bengals can't get over this Pittsburgh hump, so why does Marvin Lewis keep his job year after year? Next up for the ongoing Steelers reality TV show, a bye week in which Le'Veon Bell is expected to report for work, even though the team hasn't heard from him, and even though his replacement, James Conner, is doing great work, and Big Ben is lobbying for Conner to stay in the lineup. As always, stay tuned for the new twist in Pittsburgh. And what the hell is wrong with the Jaguars? Their once vaunted defense, symbolized by the yapping Jalen Ramsey. Where is Jalen Ramsey today? Throttled by a dazzling Dak Prescott, Zeke Elliott, and the Cowboys. Maybe Conor McGregor should join Jerry Jones and the players in the pregame huddle more often. Did you see that? Conor McGregor partying with Jerry Jones. Whew. We summarize the rest of Week 6 with these brief observations. The Bears blew a shot to be taken seriously when their celebrated defense, Khalil Mack, no-show on Sunday, was thrashed by the long-lost Brock Osweiler, who engineered a winning comeback with the help of explosive playmaker Albert Wilson. The Chargers will make a run in the AFC. That was short. So will Za'Darius Smith and the Ravens, who sacked Marcus Mariota 11 times, 11, in a shutout of the Titans, Is there a more overperforming player in the history of fantasy football than Minnesota receiver Adam Thielen? I don't think so, Sam Darnold is settling down, avoiding mistakes, and becoming the most reliable at the moment of those rookie quarterbacks, I can't explain the Washington Redskins, who lead the lousy NFC East after Josh Norman responded to a primetime benching with a big game and a win over equally baffling Carolina. But I do know empty seats when I see them, and the disgust over owner Dan Snyder's longtime bungling was evidenced Sunday by more than 20,000 unoccupied seats in Maryland. And why is somebody named Nathan Peterman employed as a professional quarterback? My mailman should have been playing for the Buffalo Bills, not Peterman, who absolutely choked that game away and will not be employed starting today. I wish him well in life. He should not be on an NFL field. And if you howled when LSU handed $10 million over 4 years to a defensive coordinator, now you know why. Dave Aranda's defense shut down the prolific Georgia offense, and with Coach Ed Orgeron succeeding with repeated gambles on fourth down, the national college football title picture was rattled over the weekend. Suddenly, Georgia out, and Notre Dame joining Alabama, Ohio State, and Clemson in the projected Final Four. With a reminder, it's still mid-October. But let me say this about LSU. The Tigers have an opportunity to crash the bash in a few weeks when Alabama comes to Death Valley. And I wonder how Aranda will handle Tua Tagovailoa and also Jalen Hurts after Tua aggravated a knee sprain in a win over Missouri and reminded us why Nick Saban is the king of college football. Rather than chase Hurts out of the program when Tua became the starter, Saban coddled and protected his former starter, knowing Hurts is a golden option if Tagovailoa was injured. But I also wonder how Saban's defense, soft at times, deals with an LSU running game that rushed for 275 yards. That's a huge game in a couple of weeks. For now, Notre Dame is number four. The Irish and their new quarterback, Ian Book, continue to stumble against teams they should blow out, needing a comeback to beat Pittsburgh after struggling earlier with Vanderbilt. But a monster signature victory is there. Michigan looming larger, and also a win at Virginia Tech. That said, there is not a ranked team left on the schedule, meaning Notre Dame must win out against the likes of rival USC and Syracuse and finish undefeated. Remember, Notre Dame as an independent gets the easy break without having to play a conference title game, but there isn't an unbeaten team out there to take advantage when that sort of team could. West Virginia blew a shot to make national noise, losing at Iowa State. Washington out, Penn State out, James Franklin not backing up his tough talk in Unhappy Valley. Suddenly on the periphery, Michigan, Jim Harbaugh finally quieting the growing criticism by pounding Wisconsin, and the Wolverines can make their Final Four case by beating Michigan State and Ohio State, both games on the road, and winning the Big Ten title game. You might say too tall a task, but if quarterback Shea Patterson and the offense are as dynamic as they were against the Badgers, look out. Maybe Harbaugh has the last laugh. Maybe he goes back to tweeting again. Central Florida, for those dreamers who won a non-Power 5 team in the Final Four, is unbeaten again, though barely, after sneaking past Memphis, so you can dream on. And Florida did not impress anybody by struggling against Vanderbilt. That's two mentions of Vandy in one podcast. Linebacker James Houston was ejected for a blindside targeting violation. And then Florida dipped into chaos when Coach Dan Mullen engaged in a heated exchange with Vandy coach Derek Mason, which led to both benches clearing and another Florida player ejected, though not before that player fought his own assistant coaches when he refused to leave the sideline. They had to pretty much drag him out of the stadium. Okay, here were Mason and Mullen wisely saying all the right things afterward when this country of ours certainly doesn't need a college football riot.
I talked to Dan at the end of that ball game. I mean, that was just a matter of, obviously, players down and, their player on the sideline and says something and, he directs it at me and I say something back and Dan gets mad and, that's how it started. Obviously, at the end of the day, we're just trying to make sure, that we can, play the game the right way, keep the game safe and make sure, everybody walks out of this. It's a referee's job to referee. To referee the game, not ours. And so when it's all said and done, obviously, you're just talking about, coaches who are extremely competitive. But, I got a lot of respect for Dan. He respects the process, so do I, so we keep it moving.
Yeah, we're not going to get into that publicly at all. It's all Greg. Derek's a really close friend of mine, I think we both, our sideline, we got to make sure our sideline, we're cleaner in that situation. And I'm sure he probably thinks the same thing, but there's nothing carrying over from that and nothing to get into publicly.
And undaunted by the convergence of postseason baseball, the NFL, and college football, the crackling hot National Basketball Association again launches its regular season here in mid-October with the usual overpowering question. Can any team other than the Warriors beat the Warriors, even with LeBron here in L.A., Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward healthy in Boston, and Carmelo Anthony in Houston? Sorry, that was a joke. The Carmelo part was a joke. The Rockets have regressed. More on that later. The champs are gunning for the first three-peat since those two runs put together by the Michael Jordan Bulls, the dynasty to which Golden State ultimately is being compared. But as we learned last spring when they fell behind the Rockets in the Western Finals, these guys have a way of toying with our minds. I think we've learned our lesson. I was the one saying, they're going down. Yeah, all right. Shut up, Jay. This time, they will toy with the free agency uncertainty of Kevin Durant, whether he wants to show he can take on more difficult challenges in a place like New York or elsewhere and disprove that mercenary cupcake thing hanging over his head, or maybe whether he joins LeBron in L.A. to stall the Warriors, or whether Durant just accrues more titles by the Bay. I think he stays. I know there are those who think Durant and Klay Thompson are leaving next summer and perhaps Draymond Green the following summer, but restraint is advised again. The Warriors moving into a San Francisco palace next year. Owner Joe Lacob will spend potentially hundreds of millions in repeater tax money to keep this band together. He'll do that. And who, even Durant, wants to duck away now when this team has a chance to win five, six, I don't know how many titles and go down among the all-time great teams in sports. But first, the Dubs must win number four amid the nostalgia of Oracle Arena's final season. And who arrives in, I don't know, a couple of months probably to help out, but bargain rate all-star Boogie Cousins on the mend. And Boogie, if healthy, gives this team a complete all-star starting five laughable and a post-presence that could make this the best of all the Warriors teams. If he stays healthy, if he doesn't get mad when he's not touching the ball, and he behaves himself on and off the court. Steph Curry, who says he's primed to be an even better shooter and player this season, look out, certainly is not afraid of the three-peat talk.
I mean, we talk about the three-peat just because it's in front of us. I don't think that's something that's repeated every single day.
Three-peated every single day.
Yeah, but when we
thanks.
When we start the season, obviously we lay everything on the table as to what is at stake in terms of our expectations. And yes, winning a championship is the goal. How you get there and how you kind of break up that mission on a day-to-day, game by game, month by month basis is what makes us, I think, great in terms of encouraging each other, being in tune with some of the things that might be thrown at you, whether it's injuries, whether it's, you know, a couple slumps on the court from, you know, playing wise or whatever the case is. And we adapt really well, and we don't stay down for too long. So in terms of like the overall goal, just depends on the day in terms of how we communicate it. But yeah, we understand that right now winning a championship is attainable if we take care of our business. And doing it 3 years in a row is a tremendous opportunity for us that we should not be afraid to talk about and go after.
And I can't say this enough. LeBron, in his new role as elder statesman with no championship expectations, is in no position to do anything in L.A. but squeeze into a lower playoff berth this season, maybe 6-7 seed. The Lakers remain in incubator mode, and James has been known to turn into a monster, a moody guy, when his teammates are sluggish or they're immature. So growth is vital for the likes of Brandon Ingram, Kyle Kuzma, Josh Hart, and Lonzo Ball, whose loudmouth father, LeVar, has been suspiciously quiet lately. Where is LeVar Ball? Maybe I shouldn't say anything. Maybe I jinxed the situation. Or maybe LeBron has threatened to drown LeVar's ass in the ocean. Here was Lonzo speaking of LeBron with reverence, though Lonzo's supposed revamped shooting mechanics still look suspect to me.
What was it meant to you to have LeBron be so supportive of you, especially in recent days?
I mean, it's just nice having him around because he's been through all this, you know, times 10. So he helps me a lot. You know, if I ever need to go to him, I can. He talks me through the game. He's like a big brother, pretty much.
expect the Lakers to make the playoffs. As I said, around 6-7. They're still excellent teams in the West. Don't think LeBron's just going to show up and go to Utah and win basketball games. Go to Portland and win on opening night. No, he's going to lose a lot of road games with this team. I think they'll exit in the first round, whereupon LeBron does start getting mad and he demands Durant, or maybe a deal for Anthony Davis, who is lonely in New Orleans and ready to take over this league for the next 10 years, if he hasn't already, in a place such as Los Angeles. The team to watch right now in regard to Golden State, not only at the moment, but I think for years to come in the East, is Boston, of course. The Celtics came within a few clanked three-pointers of reaching the league finals without Irving and Hayward. So now that these two are back and joining Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Al Horford, and that load of talent that gained so much playoff experience, look out. We'll finally have a younger powerhouse that isn't Cleveland. That was getting so dull and boring. And the Celtics, of course, coached by the remarkable Brad Stevens. And at some point, I think the Celtics, if they keep it together, could upend the Golden State dynasty. Expect to see those teams playing in the postseason for a while. I know they're dreaming in Philly, more on the Sixers in a minute. Irving, by the way, settled down some nervous souls in New England when he announced he'll be re-signing with the Celtics next summer, which could pave the way for an MVP season from Kyrie this season. The Celtics will continue their rivalry with the 76ers, who did not land LeBron, and they need to grow up on and off the court. And that means you, Joel Embiid, and Ben Simmons. I love their enthusiasm, but they're immature. And Boston is all grown up. And that's the difference right now between those two franchises. Also, much depends on the progress of Markelle Fultz, who literally forgot how to shoot the ball last season. And wishful thinking is the theme in Toronto, where the Raptors broke up their roster with the iffy hopes that Kawhi Leonard will love it there so much that he'll sign long-term, as Paul George did in Oklahoma City. Also, Leonard, perhaps more importantly at the moment, must prove he's healthy after battling that mysterious quad injury for two seasons. Here was the weirdest soundbite of the postseason, when the enigmatic Leonard he trotted out one of the goofiest laughs I've ever heard. I don't think we've ever heard this guy say more than eight words together in a monotone. Where did he come up with this laugh?
How would you describe yourself, and what would you like people to know about you?
I'm a fun guy. Obviously, I love the game of basketball. I mean, it's just more question you have to ask me in order for me to tell you about myself. I just can't give you a whole spiel. I don't even know where you're sitting at.
The team to watch in the East is Milwaukee, where the Greek freak, Giannis Antetokounmpo, I can still say it fine, I haven't said it in months, also could be the league MVP in a cake division with a new coach in Mike Budenholzer and shooters in Ersan Ilyasova and rookie Dante DiVincenzo. Try saying Ersan Ersan Ilyasova and Dante DiVincenzo 10 times. Okay, try saying it once. Out West, Houston has taken a step backward, as I said, by losing two defensive stalwarts in Ariza and Mba Amute, then listening to Chris Paul and acquiring Carmelo, who never has been a winner and isn't going to start now with attitude and defensive issues for a team that must play defense to contend. You honestly see Carmelo playing wing defense? I see him pouting a lot when he doesn't get the ball. The team to watch is Utah, dangerous last season, now primed for an even better season from defensive master Rudy Gobert in the middle, and scoring revelation Donovan Mitchell. As for the Thunder, the knee issues of Russell Westbrook shouldn't be poo-pooed when you consider the turbo explosiveness he requires to be at an optimum level. Another season with George will help, but as his frenemy Durant wins another title, yeah, I'm going out on the limb with that, Westbrook will be left to eat seafood in Oklahoma, as that commercial goes. As for the Jimmy Butler farce, he is still a Timberwolf as I record this, with coach Tom Thibodeau continuing to ignore the All-Stars' trade demands and saying he expects Butler to play in the season opener Wednesday in San Antonio. The opponents, the Spurs, don't even have to show up. The Timberwolves will be too busy trying to beat each other up. And I think I mean that literally. Now it's time for The Buzz, our deep dive into sports and life. Chris joins the program. Chris, with due respect to the Brewers and the Dodgers, I am watching superior teams in the Astros and the Red Sox. What do you make of the two championship series so far? And let me point out that you were spot on in doubting the other day that Kershaw is back for good. Give yourself a gold star on your forehead.
Yeah, Jay, did you like that effort by Clayton Kershaw? How about Dave Roberts putting Alex Wood in game two? It wasn't the first pitch, like in the NLDS, but the third pitch was homered out at Miller Park. I like that Miller Park mascot. I don't know his name. The one that goes down the slide. That'd be a fun job, just to go down the slide every time the Brewers hit a home run. I digress. Astros, Red Sox, I'm not as into it, simply because it's not the Dodgers, and there's so much football going on. It's hard to squeeze in those ALCS games. But impressive that the Astros are back full strength, and that the Red Sox, who have seemed unstoppable, are seeming to have a bit of a challenge there with the Astros. So I do think you are right that it's much more the World Series happening in the ALCS than the actual World Series will be. I think either of those teams will blow away either the Brewers or the Dodgers. I think the Brewers, but that's just me.
And Chris, have you seen anything weirder this football season than Conor McGregor and Jerry Jones jumping up and down and yelling and trying to motivate the Cowboys in their pregame huddle? It worked! They clocked Jacksonville. Does this mean Conor McGregor is going to show up every home game in Dallas? God help Dallas, Texas.
I didn't understand what Conor McGregor was doing there with Jerry Jones. It all seemed very odd. Now, Conor McGregor had a good sport jacket on, but the throw that went viral on social media on Sunday, it was all very odd. It's very odd. And Jerry Jones is sort of becoming an odd guy. He's becoming an Al Davis, kind of. Just, you know, his team actually performed on Sunday. I think they thought it was week 1, fine with Jay. But we'll see if that continues for the Cowboys. But just very interesting stuff. I don't really understand the point of it all. But we're talking about it, so there you go.
And Chris, the NBA season launches with only injuries. Are the Warriors themselves able to get in the way, I think, of a fourth Golden State NBA title? So as we await a Warriors-Celtics finals, there's an arena across the way from where you work. It's called Staples Center, and LeBron James now calls it home, knowing how difficult he can be to work with, play with, when he's losing games. How do you believe he and the Lakers will do this season, with the prime mission trying to groom these kids for future postseason contention? Chris, if the Lakers are bounced in the first round, I think the city is going to be disappointed, and I think LeBron's going to be pissed off that the city is disappointed. Every time somebody throws out expectations to him, he fires back a snide comment. I think he thinks he is allowed all sorts of leverage here. I don't think he understands fully the impact of Lakers history and the ghosts of Kobe and Magic and Kareem. No, it's not fair to expect LeBron to do anything but lose the first round, but that's what's going to happen, Chris. And when that happens, how is LA going to react? And how is LeBron going to react when you know that the Dodgers are in the NLCS and the Rams could be headed to a Super Bowl? High expectations around here.
I think the city is expecting a little too much from LeBron, especially how he's looked in the preseason. I mean, they've looked good. They've looked good. But no matter what, for them to make the postseason is huge considering how many years it's been. And LeBron in the purple and gold, if he makes it a little bit better, it'll be exciting. It's going to be exciting no matter what. People in LA are pumped up. If they made it to the playoffs and got bounced in the first round, I think people would be happy with that. The problem will be is if they next year only go to the first round and get bounced, that will be a problem. But this year, he's got house money, Jay. He's got house money. He's playing with a blank check. If they make the playoffs, even if they got bounced in the first round, LA will be excited for the Lakers back in the postseason. And there will be LeBron, and there will be Magic smiling as the guy who brought LeBron here.
Thanks, Chris, which leads us to our final segment, quickies, which are just that quick. The 76ers won't be winning a championship, but they do lead the NBA in burner accounts after fake Twitter feeds cost Brian Colangelo his job as basketball boss. New general manager Elton Brand is dealing with a racist tweet posted by Bob Muscala, the father of new Sixers forward Mike Muscala, about Jimmy Butler and the tension involving the Timberwolves. Dad did his son no favors in that locker room, and Mike had to release a statement denouncing his father. Between Embiid's wild tweets and the love life of Simmons, who at least is out of the Kardashian web at the moment, this team might regress this season if Coach Brett Brown doesn't corral his kids. Is this junior high school? Why would USA Gymnastics, after the Larry Nassar scandal and the hideous dysfunction within, hire as its interim president and CEO a certain Mary Bono, a former Republican congresswoman who was critical on a tweet last month of Nike's controversial ad campaign involving Colin Kaepernick? The appointment immediately got the attention of America's biggest gymnastics star, Simone Biles, who tweeted, quote, "Mouth drop, don't worry, it's not like we needed a smarter USA Gymnastics president or any sponsors or anything," unquote. You talk about a tone-deaf organization. How many times can USA Gymnastics, as well as the embattled U.S. Olympic Committee, be so embarrassing? I mean, that's a soft word. Disgraceful. Pathetic. Disgusting. Almost criminal. And I try very hard not to rip ESPN on this podcast. I really do. But every week, the four-initialed monster gives me more shameful ammunition. This time on a busy Saturday night in sports, vying for attention, ESPN hyped up its late-evening telecast of the Terrence Crawford-Jose Benavidez Jr. fight by showing the weigh-in, which everybody knew was going to turn ugly after a contentious week between those fighters. This comes after the fiasco in Vegas the week before with mixed martial arts and Dana White and McGregor and the dude from the Dagestan. See, I got the country right. And rather than ignore it professionally, ESPN dove right in with this weigh-in and then showed it repeatedly.
Andre, how does a fighter like Benavidez control his emotions in what's been a very emotional week?
The fight started.
And now he hit him.
The fight started early.
He hit him.
The fight started early.
And look at the police. The police move in right away. They had extra security for this weigh-in.
You know, once upon a time, ESPN stood for high standards. When I worked there, there were high standards. I mean, I worked there. There were high standards. Now it sells out to trash stuff like all the others. Who won the fight later in the night? I don't know. I don't care. I didn't watch. I may have watched, but then I had to watch that crap earlier, so it turned me off. That's our show. For our producer and editor, Chris, I am Jay, reminding you to never, ever let anybody mute you in life.